Hi, this is Carolyn Sloan from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas.
Hello, welcome to Jane Austen's Gardens, Love in the Shrubbery, presented by Maine Festival of the Book. Kim Wilson joins us from Wisconsin, where she's a writer, editor, gardening enthusiast, and a longtime member of the Jane Austen Society of North America. She's the author of Tea with Jane Austen, and more recently, In the Garden with Jane Austen. In the latter, in this book, she matches beautiful photographs of actual locations with excerpts and references from Austen's novels and letters. By placing the gardens in this historical context, she shows how nature and gardens influence Jane Austen's life and writings. Without further ado, Kim Wilson.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to Maine. I'm so excited to be here. I haven't been in here but about 20 years, so. Who has read a Jane Austen book in this group? I thought that would be the case. And what is your favorite?
Persuasion.
Pride and Prejudice.
Sense and
Sensibility. Oh, really? Good. Probably. Does anyone say Mansfield Park?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay, good. That's a rare opinion, but that's still very good. I think if her reputation only rested on that book, she would still have quite the reputation. Well, that's a treat to be speaking to a group where I don't have to maybe explain everything. I also wanted to mention before I forget that. Do you know about the Jane Austen Society? Okay, a lot of people don't, and it's a wonderful surprise if you're a Jane Austen fan and you didn't know. There's a national society. It's the Jane Austen Society of North America. There's also an English one. You can just Google that, and it's actually jasna.org, Jane Austen Society of North America.org. And there are links to chapters, and I'm pretty sure there's a Maine chapter. But it's a wonderful group, not snobbish in the slightest. We have full professors who do academic things, and we have people who I know have only seen the movies, and that's fine. However, we come to Jane Austen, it's a good thing. So, and gradually we'll get them in. They'll read the books eventually. And forgive me, by the way, I woke up in the middle of the night with a cold. You can probably hear it. I'm descending into Lauren Bacall registers here. Well, Jane Austen loved a garden, and people wonder, how I know that. But I do believe that you can see that in her books. The good characters love gardens. The bad characters do not have an appreciation of nature. It's pretty clear. And then for confirmation of that, in her letters to her sister, when she writes to her sister Cassandra, they often were separated when they'd stay. One would stay at their brother's house, and then they would write to each other. Unfortunately, we have a lot of her letters left. But she often writes about the family plans for planting fruit, flowers, trees, and shrubs in their gardens. Now, Jane Austen's father was a minister, so they were never rich, really. Of the gentry, but essentially sort of middle class. Never very poor, but never entirely free from worry. They grew their own food wherever they could, which is very common at the time. If you had any space at all, you would grow your own food and raise chickens and such. When they lived in town, they almost always had at least a little town garden. On Gay Street in Bath. Has anyone been to the Jane Austen Center in Bath? That was sort of fun. There's a dentist's office there. I was very bold. I marched up to the door and went inside, and the receptionist in her smock, yes, may I help you? Could I see your garden? And so they very kindly let me go in and take a picture of that. And then later in life, she and her mother returned to Chawton Cottage. And has anyone been to Chawton? If you go, it's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you go to London and you're a Jane Austen fan, you must go to Chawton Cottage. It is only an hour or so to the west of London, very easy drive, and it's a wonderful, wonderful museum dedicated to her life and works, and they're actually redoing it now, taking some of the tourist things out, out of the house itself and putting them there, building a new outbuilding that looks authentic from the era. And so the shop and all those things are going out, and the inside is very much more like it would have been when she was there. They even have the little table that she wrote her novels on. Now, in the course of her life, she had a chance to visit many grander gardens that it would have inspired, some of the scenes we see in her novels. Her rich brother was a very lucky man. He was adopted by some rich childless cousins and inherited two estates. And Chawton House has the Chawton Cottage on its property, so that's how she came to live there. And then even grander estates, Stoneleigh Abbey up in Warwickshire, that one of her cousins owned and that she visited. And so you can see that even though she herself did not have a great deal of money, she moved in the circles where she would have seen the grand houses that would have inspired Pemberley, for example, in Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Darcy's estate. Chatsworth, this is the one that everyone thinks this is Pemberley. And I'll go for that. I think that looks like a reasonable house for Mr. Darcy. We think that Jane Austen probably visited this as a tourist. And certainly in Pride and Prejudice, we see Elizabeth Bennet and her aunt and uncle touring this area in Derbyshire in the Peaks District, which is where Mr. Darcy's Pemberley is supposed to be. Jane Austen is famous for only writing what she knew. So even though we can't always verify that she was at a place, you know, she put it in her books. The description matches very closely. Although those of us who are Colin Firth fans maybe think Lime Hall is it. This was in the A&E version of Pride and Prejudice. So this becomes Pemberley. That works too, I think. Gardens play an important roles in all six of Jane Austen's novels. For every house mentioned in the novels, pretty much, there is a garden. Fanny Price and Mr. Rushworth near the Ha Ha, a little fence that keeps the livestock from going up into the family areas, the pleasure grounds. And so that, if you've ever wondered, is the ground will go out and then drop away. And if you're standing at the house looking out, it looks like there's nothing there, very natural, which was the desired effect. If you're reading along and you wonder what a ha-ha is, that's a ha-ha. Mr. Rushworth has an old-fashioned garden and park in Mansfield Park called Southerton that he wants to improve. You've heard of that, the improvement of the estate. It's an old, probably geometric pattern, the old European style, and he wants it to be the modern, new English landscape style. Mr. Collins, in Pride and Prejudice, has his little parsonage garden, which we know his wife encourages him to work in as much as he can. And even arrogant General Tilney has acres and acres of garden that he's very pleased to boast about in Northanger Abbey. For some of Jane Austen's characters, though, gardens are more than a source of food or flowers. They're places of refuge and spiritual refreshment. Many of the important scenes in the novels take place outdoors, you'll notice when you start looking at it. Austen's heroines find privacy and solace, even love, in the garden. Elizabeth Bennet walks in the groves of Rosings to ponder Darcy's letter. Fanny Price finds what Austen calls animation, both of body and mind, in the gardens of Mansfield Park. And Emma soothes her nerves with a walk in the shrubbery. Jane Austen valued these renewing qualities of a garden herself, writing from her brother's house in London. "The garden is quite a love. I live in the room downstairs. It is particularly pleasant from opening upon the garden. I go and refresh myself every now and then come back to solitary coolness." Tragically, the garden at her brother's house does not exist. The house is still there. They redid it in sort of this awful Victorian brick. It's in Hans Place in the very upscale western end of London, you know, the Sloane Ranger area. I don't know if you know how the richer areas of London were constructed, but they had the houses set around a central square, and those gardens were private, locked. Some of them are open now. This one is still private, and I scampered around the edges peering through and trying to take pictures. Couldn't get anyone to let me in. So when I was there, it was full of nannies and people, you know, airing the people's rich children. It's kind of funny. So anyway, his garden is gone, but the right in front of his house is still there. So I'd like to give you a tour of the different sorts of gardens that Jane Austen knew and visited and which I think informed her work. And I'll look in particular at the gardens of her family, some of which you'll be pleased to know still exist. And a lot of them, they're restoring to something approaching their original form, or as best as they can do. I hope it will give you a better understanding, anyway, and appreciation of the settings in which Austen's novels take place and the gardens where her characters walked. In Sense and Sensibility, Jane Austen describes the cottage the Dashwood women move to when they have to move out of their grand estate when Mr. Dashwood dies, because then the son comes in and he takes over, and so the widow and her daughters move. As a house, Barton Cottage was comfortable and compact, but as a cottage, it was defective, for the building was regular, the roof was tiled, the window shutters were not painted green, nor were the walls covered with honeysuckles. In Jane Austen's England, cottage gardens came in many sizes and styles. At the lower end of the spectrum We have a laborer's tiny cottage, and this is the true cottage. This is what most working people were living in, a truly tiny cottage with a thatch roof. Your garden there would have been devoted to raising food and pigs. You know, no, perhaps to sneak in a few flowers. And good landlords were encouraged to help them plant, you know, not only food to sustain them, but something to dress it up. But pretty wretched, really. At the other extreme were the cottages of the rich. Houghton Lodge, not very far from Chawton, so this is worth a visit. They have lovely ornamental gardens that are open to the public. It's called a cottage ornée, or an ornamented cottage. And you may have actually seen this in various BBC productions. This was in David Copperfield and Wilde and the Buccaneers. And they have restored the grounds to their late 18th century appearance. Very nice. This, to me, is reminiscent of Upper Cross Cottage in Persuasion, with its French windows and other prettiness. I think that Upper Cross Cottage probably could be described as a cottage ornée, because they took a regular cottage and dressed it up and expanded it and so forth. And Jane Austen actually uses the term cottage ornée in Sanditon, which is one of her unfinished novels. So when you run out of things to read, when you've gone through the six novels as many times as you can, then you start to read her fragments, and they're worth it. Although it amuses me, she was working on Sanditon when she died, and it's wonderful, just the four chapters or so that are there. But I always picture, you know, that thing like the 10 people you meet in heaven or whatever it is. I picture this line of Jane Austen people there, you know, tell me, how did it end? You know, I have to know. People at the time had a very, I think, amusing notion of what life was like in the country. And they would write poems about it and plays, and they just waxed lyrical about the whole thing. And really it all wrapped around the fact that if you did not live in a mansion, it must necessarily be a cottage. You know, if it's not grand and with 100 servants, why, then we're living simply, you know. And I always think of Marie Antoinette playing, you know, milkmaid in her little cottage at Versailles. Barton Cottage in Sense and Sensibility and Jane Austen's own cottage at Chawton, fall somewhere in the middle. Certainly not fancy, but respectable enough for less well-off gentlewomen to live in. Jane Austen and her mother and her sister and a friend named Martha Lloyd moved back here after Mr. Austen died. And in fact, this is the 200th anniversary this coming July of their moving in there. So if you are fortunate enough to be able to go to England, they have all sorts of wonderful 200th anniversary activities. Now, as I said, Jane Austen's rich brother owned the cottage here as part of his estate of Chawton. And the way it worked then is that a rich landowner would own thousands and thousands of acres, often a whole village. Really, I think about 90% of the property in England was owned by the great landowners like Mr. Darcy. And so her brother was fortunate, very fortunate. You know, here his father was just a minister, middle class sort of, and he inherited two grand estates. But then he was able to give his mother and sisters a place to live when they needed one. Although, you know, I mean, I think the least he could have done was had her picture painted, you know. If you go to Chawton Cottage, there's a lovely oil painting of him done when he was a boy on the occasion of his adoption by these cousins. And it annoys me every time I see it. Why does he get an oil painting and we don't have one of Jane Austen? So when Edward had this, it was his steward's house, and he had it fixed up so it would be fit for gentlewomen. So he had made some improvements. He put in kitchen gardens. I mean, they were practical things. They still were growing a lot of their own food, because this is what you do. There was no supermarket. You could buy a few things from the neighboring houses. But if you're in a country village, you would grow your own things. We have records of Mrs. Austen. You know, they planted strawberries and potatoes and gooseberries and currants and raised chickens and so forth. So there were not only practical elements of this little cottage garden, but Edward installed features, the rich brother Edward, that would have been fit for gentlewomen. And he put a shrubbery walk in that surrounded the whole of the property. And you needed a shrubbery, which winds through trees and flowers and, of course, shrubs. They were considered necessary features for the delicately nurtured ladies of the time, because it provided them with a shady place to walk and take exercise. In Mansfield Park, Lady Bertram advises Mr. Rushworth to put a shrubbery on his grounds. "If I were you," she says, "I would have a very pretty shrubbery. One likes to get out into a shrubbery in fine weather." Though if you know Lady Bertram, who seems to exist in sort of a laudanum-induced semi-stupor all the time, it's sort of hard to imagine her summoning up the energy to go out into walking in the shrubbery. The most important feature of a shrubbery, besides the shrubs, were the gravel paths, as I said, which drained quickly and kept your feet dry. Now, in Jane Austen's day, people thought that wet feet could kill you. Ladies, people knew, were especially delicate, and they had their little flimsy shoes, and they knew that they could die of the least little thing. A blighted love affair, you know, would carry you off, or in this case, you know, wet feet, just like that, kill you instantly. Now, we know Jane Austen believed this, too, and this is just common wisdom, because in Sense and Sensibility, remember Marianne Dashwood, when the worthless Willoughby deserts her, she wanders, quote, not merely on the dry gravel of the shrubbery, but in the wilder, wet, grassy part of the grounds, too. Getting her feet wet, she contracts an illness that nearly kills her. And this would not have happened if she had had the sense to stay in the shrubbery. So. In 1801, Jane Austen's father retired as minister of Steventon, and he moved to Bath, which is a lovely city, but it's really a contrast to having lived in this lovely, lovely, you know, the lanes and fields and wildflowers of a country parsonage. And there's a lot of debate, actually, about whether or not Jane Austen liked Bath. We see that some of her characters love it and some hate it. In her later book, Persuasion, the good characters seem mostly to hate it. So, based on that, I would say that she liked to visit, but she didn't really like to be forced to live there. Bath, like all the towns of the time, was terribly noisy and smoky and dirty, you know, all these coal fires. Not quite as bad as London, but quite bad enough that the buildings, well, when they first put them up, they were the lovely golden stone, but very quickly got very dirty. And I think it must have been a terrible contrast to her home. I think we see Austen's opinion of Bath reflected in Persuasion, and when Anne Elliot talks about, you know, disliking the city, the noise of the city, quote, the heavy rumble of carts and drays, the bawling of newspaper men, muffin men and milkmen, and the ceaseless clink of pattens. Pattens were these iron rings that you would put on your shoes, ladies put on their shoes to keep them up out of the mud. Later, Jane Austen wrote, it will be 2 years tomorrow since we left Bath, with what happy feelings of escape. So I think that's pretty clear. I've often wondered what compensation Jane Austen could possibly have found in Bath for the loss of their large parsonage garden. Well, most of the houses, most of them had these long, narrow gardens behind them, only as wide as the house, but then they'd have high walls on each side, and you could get a bit of a garden going in there if you could get plants that would withstand the smoke and the soot and, you know, the bad air, bad soil, bad water. But still, they were like a little green oasis. If what you had, you know, you take what you have. Their main house, number 4 Sydney Place, which is in private ownership. You can get in there by special arrangement, but it's not generally open for tours. But this is right across from Sydney Gardens, which Jane Austen was very excited when she found they were going to live there. She went across the street and walked there nearly every day. So this, I think, is not only her garden in the back, but this was her main source of, you know, something approaching a little bit of a touch of country. Great estates in Jane Austen's day were show places for the wealth and power of the British elite, with beautiful parkland filled with magnificent tree-lined avenues, grottos, classically inspired temples, bridges, and columns, and acres of gardens and exquisitely landscaped grounds. The gardens of Pemberley, where Jane Austen tells us from every window there were beauties to be seen, represent the very best of the grand English landscape garden style. Now, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of debate, you know, which estate inspired it. Was it Chatsworth? Was it her brother's house, Godmersham, which is very nice, but I'm not quite sure is up to Darcy standards. Jane Austen tells us that the park at Pemberley is 10 miles round, which if you look at guidebooks of the time and see, and the people would travel as tourists to these big houses, just like we do now, even though they were in private ownership, and the housekeeper would take you on a tour, and then they'd hand you over to the gardener, which is what happens in Pride and Prejudice. The guidebook, she tells us that Pemberley is 10 miles around. That puts it in the same category as Chatsworth, which was 9 miles in circumference, or even Blenheim Palace, which the guidebooks of the time said was 11 or 12 miles around. So this puts Darcy amongst the very, very richest landowners of England. And naturally, these estates had huge gardens. A guidebook at the time said that Blenheim's gardens covered 200 acres, including 8 acres devoted to the kitchen gardens alone. And they had ornamental temples, bridges, water cascades, flowers, gardens nestled in wooded groves and sheltered walks, the guidebook tells us, between clumps and groups of the most luxuriant and delicate trees of various climes, intermixed with flowers and shrubs of the utmost fragrance and beauty. So I like to imagine that Pemberley would have rivaled that. I mean, clearly. Although it's kind of interesting. This is just for the owners of the house. You know, they're just them and their guests. Certainly, Elizabeth Bennet thinks that Pemberley's grounds are perfect. Quote, "She had never seen a place for which nature had done more, or where natural beauty had been so little counteracted by an awkward taste. They were all of them warm in their admiration, and at that moment she felt that to be mistress of Pemberley might be something. Though, those of us who are fans of Mr. Darcy think she probably didn't need additional persuasion." Well, now you have an idea of what the garden sites that Jane Austen would have been at, and I hope it gives you an appreciation for what her inspirations for certain scenes in her novels might have been, especially the scenes that I like to think of as the a shrubbery of one's own scenes. As I said before, the important scenes take place outdoors, and one of the reasons for this is it's clear when we think about what life in a country house, or any house really, in Austen's time was like. It was the opposite of private. In addition to family, even the smallest of genteel households would have had at least one servant, maybe many. The Austen women themselves here, they were poor enough to be getting help from Jane Austen's brothers to help live. They were living on about the same amount of income as the Dashwood women in Sense and Sensibility, about 400, 500 pounds a year. But they still had three servants. So even in Emma, Miss Bates and Mrs. Bates, desperately, desperately poor, but they're still considered gentlewomen because it's the widow and daughter of the minister of the village. I mean, they get presents of food from friends. They have a servant. It was kind of the people were cheap and things were expensive. So you're never really very far away from somebody. There's always someone around, you know, a cook, a maid. The Austens had actually a cook, a maid, and usually an outdoor man to do the outdoor work. For Jane Austen's heroines and heroes, the path to happiness with the spouse of their choice is never smooth. Beset by misunderstanding and misfortune, plagued by their parents and families, and overwhelmed by their emotional distress, they often find it difficult to find a quiet, private place just to sit and think over their problems. And surrounded as they are by so many people, prying servants and parents alike, what are Jane Austen's distressed heroines and heroes to do? Why escape to the garden, of course? To privacy and the soothing influences of nature. If you look at the books, you'll see that nearly every one of the heroines takes refuge in the gardens and grounds of the houses at some point in the novels to gain privacy or to indulge in their emotions. And that's a word Jane Austen uses often, is indulge. In Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth and Jane Bennet, you'll see often walk in the shrubbery of their estate at Longbourn when they want to get away from their family and speak privately. And I imagine that Jane and her sister Cassandra would often have done that when they wanted to get away from Mrs. Austen. The pleasure grounds of a great country estate had lovely paths and secret nooks, which were perfect settings for lovers as well. And in Jane Austen's time, unmarried young men and women were not supposed to be alone together until you were engaged. And even then, you know, it's kind of iffy. And that rather limited their ability to do more than just converse politely. But you could get away with it by walking in the garden. This is a publicly acceptable thing to go and do. And it gives you a few more opportunities for cuddling and such. And tell me that rakes such as Willoughby, in Sense and Sensibility, didn't seize every opportunity they got to go sneaking off into the shrubbery with whatever girl they could get hold of. I'm pretty sure he spent a lot of time in the shrubbery. Jane Austen knew well how necessary privacy was to love. Jane Bennet and Bingley in Pride and Prejudice. In Mansfield Park, Austen has Fanny Price and Edmund Bertrand fall in love wandering about and sitting under trees all the summer evenings at Mansfield Park. Mr. Knightley proposes to Emma in the shrubbery, and most romantically, Darcy proposes to Elizabeth for the second successful time as they walk from her estate to a neighboring house. And indeed, if you look at the proposal scenes in the novels, almost all of them take place out of doors, with an exception or two, which is completely understandable, because who, except for that pompous nincompoop, Mr. Collins, would want to propose in front of Mrs. Bennet? I'd like to end with my favorite Austen garden quote by Fanny Price in Mansfield Park. "To sit in the shade on a fine day and look upon verdure is the most perfect refreshment." Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions. Yes.
Looking at those huge expanses of lawn on the great estates, do you have any concept of the number of people that it would have taken to keep those by hand, which is what they did.
Yeah, I actually have figures for Blenheim Palace. They had 100 gardeners devoted to the grounds. 100 people, 100 laborers. There would have been a head gardener who was a very important man. I mean, he would have been considered socially up there, not with the gentleman, but locally he would have been quite the personage. He would have had a lot of undergardeners and then laborers. And Blenheim Palace, so we're looking at the Darcy level here, and it would go down from there, had 100 laborers devoted to all of the grounds. So that would include the deer park and the woods and the places where they're, you know, they would grow wood to harvest. But in the pleasure grounds alone, and when you see that term pleasure grounds, that's near to the house with the haha keeping the livestock out where the family and their friends would walk, they had 30 laborers working the pleasure grounds alone. So probably Pemberley would have had that. Maybe 25. I mean, we'll come. Anyone else? Yes?
How many times did you read the Jane Austen books before you understood or connected the gardens with?
Well, it's one of those odd things that something occurs to you, like wondering what is a ha-ha, or, you know, what does Lady Catherine mean by a wilderness, you know, in the middle of southern England? What on earth could she possibly be talking about? And then you start to, you see it all the time. Sort of like when you break your leg, suddenly everyone's got a cast. You know, you didn't notice it before. I've lost track of how many times I've read them. But it's just, that's how, when I wrote the tea book, it's because I started noticing how tea was often the center of the social action, kind of like the way a Tom Wolfe, you know, novel might have a cocktail party. You know, who's A-list, who's B-list. I started noticing who drank tea with whom was meant something that we didn't really catch in the modern era. Well, the same thing, when I started thinking about these proposal scenes outside, I started, then you read it again, you think, oh my, look at this. Look at that her good characters love the outdoors and nature. And look that, you know, Mary Crawford we see, you know, in Mansfield Park, she seems so appealing, but ultimately we find out that morally she's not quite there. And, well, we get a clue to that earlier in her opinion of the countryside. She's a city girl. You know, well, that should have been a tip-off right there for us. You know, so I don't know. 30 times? I have no idea. Anybody else? Jane Austen Society? Jane Austen herself? We could talk about tea for a while. I don't know.
It's
they've got it out there. It's called Tea with Jane Austen. And it doesn't have pictures like this. It's the period black and white illustrations, but it's looking at tea in her time and how they were used in the novels, as I said, you know, social things. And then I also put recipes in because I was, you know, like an Emma. You think, what is a rout cake? You know, why is Mrs. Elton so upset that she can't get a good rout cake? And so I went through all the old recipe books and I made some, and oh, gosh, look, it's a little shortbread cookie. You know, who knew? And so that was fun. You know, my family liked that I tested this on them, and I've never used so much butter and sugar in my life. And I had to give away actually about half of what I made to the neighbors, or we would have all just, you know, keeled over from coronaries. But, you know, or I even have a recipe for gruel because you're reading Mr. Woodhouse and Emma, and he's so into gruel, the poor man. You know, it has to be thin, but not too thin. And I thought, what on earth does that mean? And so I went through all these recipes, and they all assume you know what you're talking about. You know, and I've often wondered, Dickens, you know, what is gruel? And you would be reading along, and I've had like 20 recipes spread out in front of me, and they would say, give you the instructions, and they'd say, strain and serve. And you think, which part? What am I keeping and what am I discarding, you know? And so, but everyone then knew, you know? So I made some up and worked at it, and I realized actually there's just a few bigger bits that are left over that would spoil the texture. She used a fine-grained oatmeal. So it really is sort of a thin, almost a drink. And then they would flavor it with wine and cinnamon and sugar and lemon or whatever occurred to you. And so now I know, thin but not too thin. So, and I've got, you know, a pound cake and just a few recipes scattered through for fun. Anyway, yes, yeah.
I don't know your bio. Is this avocational pursuit or is this your professional?
Well, It is the first, and I would love it to be the latter. Writing, you know, unless you are David Sedaris or something, is definitely don't quit your day job sort of thing. I do freelance editing and some writing. Friends of mine who write novels tell me, you know, you've got to write a whole bunch of magazine articles, and that makes up the difference. So maybe I'll start trying to convince people. You know, Jane Austen's very hot right now. So no, but I do it because I love it, definitely. Yes.
All the adaptations of
Oh. Well, they each have their positive points and they each have their flaws. I'm not one of those people who goes in, you know, real grumpy and, oh my goodness, you know, how can we be serious about Keira Knightley with all that collagen in her lips, you know, or something. And I would say the A&E version, the 1995 A&E with Jennifer Eales and Colin Firth is probably the best in terms of the spirit of it. But then you look at costumes, I mean, gosh, they did a great job in the Keira Knightley version. You know, they do always do something, and that one, it seemed a little Wuthering Heights-ish to me, you know, that scene where she's standing on the cliffside. I was forcibly reminded of the Monty Python, you know, Wuthering Heights and Semaphore scene. Have you seen that? But, you know, the costumes were great, and the interiors were wonderful. They do things in that one where they overemphasize the disparity of wealth between Elizabeth's family and Darcy's. They really want to make it clear that although she technically is a gentlewoman, she is beneath him. I think they overdid it a little bit, you know, with the pig and whatnot. But on the other hand, my teenage daughter and all her friends love it. And I think that anything that gets people excited about Jane Austen is automatically a good thing. So, yes?
I was really liking your point about the garden being the place where you can retreat from the house and the sort of the claustrophobic nature of all of these families and all of the difficulties of the family connections. And I'm wondering, is there sort of a two-tiered step in this getting outside piece where there are some heroines who, you know, go farther than the garden, and Lizzie Bennet goes, you know, gets her petticoats muddy in the lanes and walks out of the garden even.
Or
Marianne does, but I can't imagine that Eleanor ever, you know, went and rambled on the downs.
Well, you know, some of that I think is just natural that a certain character would do certain things. You know, Marianne Dashwood is out of control and overly emotional, and you know, obviously she can't be trusted to stay on the dry path like she should. On the other hand, there are people who do say that some of this was very deliberately staged by Austen, so that in Mansfield Park, when Maria Bertram is trapped at the edge of the ha-ha by the gate, and she says, "I cannot get out." You know, and then later she manages to worm her way around the edge of the gate, tearing a hole in her dress, which is thought to be rather symbolic, with the help of the man she later runs off with. And so this is, you know, she's escaping from the confines of society, and a lot of people feel that's very deliberate on Austen's part, right? Yes?
When we talk about the military and pride and prejudice that's stationed there, what would they be equivalent to in our society now?
National Guard. Yeah, the militia were raised locally by local, often the local landowners would be in charge of raising a company. But this was during the Napoleonic Wars, and so there was real fear there might be an invasion from the sea, which is why you see them, you know, they have to go to Brighton, which then that's why Lydia Bennet is wild to go to Brighton, because the militia are down there. So, that, yeah, very, very much like the National Guard, I think. The home defense. Yes?
The unfinished novel that you mentioned, the title of that?
Well, it's called Sanditon. We don't know if that's what she would have called it herself, but it takes place in a seaside town of Sanditon, which is also, you can tell she's kind of going to kind of spoof the spa and seaside resort culture that was at the time. And she was quite ill, so there's a lot of talk in there about doctors and you know, quackery and people treating themselves just randomly. And you could tell that she takes a very funny, healthy attitude about it. She makes fun of these people who coddle themselves and indulge themselves in that. And here she was ill enough that she never finished it.
In the Keira Knightley version of Pride and Prejudice, the interior of the house is much more rustic than in the BBC, A&E production. Which one would have been more realistic? And also, Mr. Bennet works more in the Keira Knightley. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's doing some labor.
Well, I would say, normally I would have said a combination of the two, because the A&E version, I think, is actually the level of the house that you would have seen. If you look at their income, I believe they had like £2,000 a year. And this is a good estate. It's just not up to Mr. Darcy's standards. But it's a good, respectable, high-level estate. And when you see the descriptions of what's on their property, I mean, they have aspirations. They have their wilderness walk. They have a hermitage, for heaven's sakes, which is a little hut meant to look like a hermit's hut. And it was just a little fashionable garden feature. So it would have been very much nicer than the Keira Knightley version, Now, as far as a landowner working, in that era, as opposed to the Victorian era, the men and the ladies were much more inclined to be hands-on. You know, they would have had a cook, and we see Mrs. Bennett making a point of that, oh, my girls have nothing to do with the kitchen. So you're starting to see the separation. But they would have been expected to know how to make these things and how to instruct the servants. By later Victorian times, it was not appropriate to do anything. And in fact, that was the distinction made at the time between if you were a gentleman or a gentlewoman or not, is do you do any labor? Does your money derive from work or not? I mean, there were a few acceptable professions, the clergy, the military, but like a doctor, for example, was not considered socially acceptable as a gentleman because he worked with his hands. He touched people. Huh. So, not, you know, there's all these different levels. Now, Mr. Bennett, probably a landowner would have been out supervising his home farm. We see Mr. Knightley do that, very respectable. He's actually out there working and supervising. I find it hard to believe that Mr. Bennett could have torn himself away from his library. You know, I think he would have been there with his nose in a book and everything could fall apart and he wouldn't notice or care. Yes.
When did some of the inheritance laws change so that women could inherit? Because a lot of those novels revolve around the women couldn't inherit.
Yeah, I really don't know. That primogeniture in England was different from the Salic law on the continent. It kept these great estates together that only the eldest son would inherit. And then the other brothers would have to find a profession, the law or the military. And they often did. They just went right down, okay, you're going to the law. You'll be our soldier. You'll be the clergyman. Which is why in Mansfield Park, Mary Crawford is very unhappy, but the younger son is going to be a minister. And she doesn't think it's good enough. But that's what you do. And I don't know when it changed. Later, I imagine. I sort of lose interest after Jane Austen's era.
Well, they wouldn't bring somebody in from outside the family as long as the male.
So mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yes. Mr. Collins was just a cousin.
Yeah.
But heaven forbid it should go to a woman.
But Lady Catherine has her own estate, yes, and I think her aunt is going to inherit.
Right, and there were estates. There were even women who inherited titles in their own right. You'll see that, you know, so-and-so baroness in her own right. Depends on how it was set up. A father could do that. You could have, if you had an estate that was not entailed, that's the word they use, and that means where it takes two generations, the father and the son would sign a legal document entailing that piece of property on the son of the son, or the next male heir. But each time the younger son came of age, it would have to be re-signed, or it could be broken. So that if it could be undone. But it took, it's not very likely that that elder son is going to agree to the property being taken away from his son and split, you know. So they usually just continued it.
Give a big hand for a couple. Thank you very much for coming.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.